When he and Mr. Gray finally came upstairs from the cellar, my father glanced at me in a strange way, suspicious, but he didn't say anything. I found that I didn't want to confront him. I told my father I was going to Amy Hurt's house, but I didn't leave. I went out to the garage and I sat on the workbench. I was in a panic. I was in a panic because I'm not built for subterfuge and deception. I sat there feeling terrible, ashamed of myself for spying on my parents. I knew they loved me, that there was a logical explanation for everything. So I went back in the house, looking for my father, to apologize. He wasn't in sight. I looked through the downstairs rooms. He wasn't there. I went upstairs. The door to their bedroom was still closed. I approached the door, intending to knock and then go inside and make a clean breast of everything I'd done. Then I heard their voices. And that changed everything. Forever.
10-second interval. And what did you hear?
It's funny. It was like that frantic whispering on that night long ago. I heard my father's voice. He was saying, "He's becoming suspicious." He was listening at the cellar door. He was trying to hear what Thompson and I were saying. For a minute, I thought he was talking about someone else altogether, another situation altogether, and I was relieved. I didn't know any Thompson. Then I heard my mother say he should stop coming here, and he should use his own name in the first place. Gray, Thompson, all these years we called him Gray, and now he's someone else. These ridiculous games he plays. There was anger in my mother's voice. I'd never heard anger there before. My father said, "He's probably got 1,000 names. That's how he survives. That's what helps us to survive." And my mother said, with the anger gone now and the old sadness in her voice again, "That's just what we're doing. Surviving. Not living."
7-second interval. "Go ahead. Use the Kleenex again." 12-second interval.
Then my father said, "We have to do something, Louise. He isn't a child anymore. Didn't you say you thought he might have been listening the other night when you talked with Martha?" I didn't hear her reply. And then I heard my father say, "No matter what Gray Thompson says, it's time to do something about Adam." And I shivered there in the hallway.
8-second interval. "It's all clear now, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"Do you wish to rest a while, or do you want to go on with it?"
"Let's go on with it."
Tape change, end OZK-011. Start tape OZK-012, 10-19, date deleted, TA.
Next thing I knew, I was downstairs in the recreation room, sitting there. I left the door open. I knew that my father would find me there eventually. I heard the phone ring, but I didn't bother answering it, although there was an extension in the room. I sat there, as if in a trance. I knew it was Amy on the phone, but Amy didn't matter at the moment. I sat there and waited for my father to come downstairs, and I don't know how much time had passed. He hadn't bothered to put on the lights, but a feeble shaft of light penetrated the room from the other part of the cellar, and it struck a ping-pong ball. The ball lay suspended in the darkness like a miniature moon. He didn't know how long he had sat there, and then he heard his father's voice. "Adam?" His father calling from the top of the stairs. "Adam, are you down there?" Adam didn't answer. His father must have sensed his presence, however, because he began to descend the steps, blocking out part of the brightness that spilled in from the cellar outside the recreation room. His father advanced to the door of the paneled room and saw him. "What are you doing down here?" he asked. "Amy called a while ago, and I told her you were on the way to her house." He looked up at his father. His good father, that worried look on his face. Whatever had happened, he trusted him completely. But Adam still didn't speak. He didn't trust himself to speak. Afraid of the words that might spill out of him, the questions he didn't want to ask, the answers he didn't want to hear. But at the same time, he wanted to know. He wanted to know everything. He was tired of pretending that nothing had happened, that the second birth certificate didn't exist, that he had not listened to that phone call. He was tired of faking it, being a fake. "Are you okay, Adam?" his father asked, a frown of concern on his forehead. His father sat down beside him on the couch. Adam looked at the ping-pong ball. It was no longer a moon, just a ball. "What's the matter?" his father asked, voice light and bantering now, the same kind of voice he used with Adam's mother during her bad times. Adam closed his eyes. And then, without planning, without preliminaries, he said, "What's it all about, Dad? Who's Mr. Gray? Or is he Mr. Thompson? Who's that woman, Martha's her name, that Mom calls every week? What's going on, Dad?" He knew that by asking the questions, he was betraying himself, admitting that he had been spying and eavesdropping. And he also knew, deeply and sadly, that the answers would change his life, that there would be things in his life, in their lives, that he hadn't known before. Maybe that's why he had delayed the questions from the very beginning, because he didn't want things to change. But the questions had been asked now, and he opened his eyes to confront his father. "Jesus," his father said, and Adam wasn't certain whether his father was swearing or praying. "Jesus," he said again, sighing, a long sigh, weariness in the sigh, and sadness, too. Such sadness. His father touched his shoulder. A gentle touch. A caress, really. "How much do you know, Adam?" "I'm not sure, Dad. Not very much." His voice sounded funny. An echo chamber voice. "Of course. I'm still not playing fair with you, asking that. You've suspected something for a while now, haven't you? I've seen you looking at me, at us, your mother and me, studying us. And lately you've been skulking around the house, listening, brooding. At first we thought it was Amy, that you were mooning about her. I tried to convince myself of that, because I've always dreaded the day when you'd ask certain questions." He sighed again. "Now the day is here. Are you going to tell me, Dad, what it's all about?" Adam asked. "I've got to know." "Of course you have to know. It's your right to know. You're not a child anymore. But I've been telling myself that for a long time, but there never seemed to be a good time for it."
"And did he tell you?"
"Yes. Yes, he told me."
"And what did he tell you?"
"That my name is Paul Del Monte. That there is no Adam Farmer."
15-second interval. "Are you able to proceed?"
"Yes, I'm all right. I'm fine."
"Then what else did your father tell you?"
"Everything."
"Everything?"
"Well, almost everything. That night I told you about the first memory, the bus. I was right about that, my father said. We were running away, going to a new place to live. And that day in the woods with the dog, we fled into the woods because my father thought he had spotted one of them."
"Who was them?" 9-second interval.
"I'm not sure. I think I knew once. Maybe it'll come back to me. But that day in the cellar, my father told me who I was, who he was, who we all were. Suddenly, I had a history. something I realized I had never had before. Everything changed in one afternoon, in that cellar, in a few hours.
His father's real name was Anthony Del Monte, and he had been a reporter in a small town in upstate New York. The name of the town was Blount, population about 30,000, famous for the high hills veined with granite that loomed above the town. Those hills drew a few Italians across the Atlantic 100 years ago, men skilled in the uses of marble and granite, among them the grandfather of Adam's father. The quarries dried up after a while, but the Italians remained and became assimilated into the town and the state. These were light-skinned, blonde Italians from northern Italy. They grew no grapes on terraced slopes. Adam's grandfather was the first of his generation to seek an education. He graduated from law school and was modestly successful, conducting a law office in the heart of Blount. Adam's father did not seek a career in the law. He was drawn by the written word. He completed his studies at Columbia University in New York City and attended the Missouri Graduate School of Journalism. With his degrees tucked into his suitcase, he returned to Blount and became a reporter for the Blount Telegrapher. Soon he was promoted to staff reporter, then to political reporter. He loved working for the newspaper. He was intrigued by the power of words, not the literary words that filled the books in the library, but the sharp, staccato words that went into the writing of news stories, words that went for the jugular, active verbs that danced and raced on the page. Roscoe Campbell, owner and editor of the Telegrapher, encouraged Adam's father to go beyond the superficial aspects of stories, to find the meanings below the surfaces, to root out what might be hidden or not apparent to the casual reader. He won the Small City Reporter of the Year Award, presented annually by the Associated Press, for a series of stories involving corruption in Blount. An official in the Public Works Department involved in kickbacks connected with purchases of snowplows and trucks. Roscoe Campbell was delighted. Occasionally, he allowed his award-winning reporter to spend a few days at the state capitol in Albany. Once again, the owner beamed with pride. How many newspapers of similar size received exclusive stories from their own man at the state house? Meanwhile, Adam's father and mother met and married. She was Louise Nolan, blue-eyed and dark-haired, a shy beauty, the younger daughter of tragic parents. Her mother had died giving birth to this second child, and her father, an artist of modest reputation in the Blount area, was seduced by beer, whiskey, rum or rye or whatever bomb came in bottles. He froze to death one January night, having tumbled in a stupor to the snow-covered pavement of a back alley. The hard-working young reporter rescued Louise Nolan from her grief, and they were eventually married in St. Joseph's Church, Adam's mother having been a devout Catholic all her life. Religion, in fact, had always sustained her through bad periods, particularly after her father died. The wedding was modest and unpretentious. The parents of both were dead, and they had only a scattering of distant relatives in that section of the state. After a honeymoon at Niagara Falls, they settled down in a 5-room ranch house in Blount, in the shadows of those hills that had drawn Adam's forebears to the town. Soon Adam was born, a sweet and docile child. Adam blushed at his father's description of him. And life was good. Life was fine.
Yes, yes, I see, I see.
You sound impatient. I'm sorry, am I going into too much detail? I thought you wanted me to discover everything about myself.
Well, yes, of course I do. I apologize for my seeming impatience. We have such a long way to go together. 5-second interval.
What do you really want to know about me? What's this questioning really about?
Must we discuss motive again? We have agreed that these sessions are journeys to discover your past, and I am willing to serve as your guide.
But I sometimes wonder what's more important, what I find out about myself or what you find out about me.
You must avoid these needless doubts. They only delay the process of discovery, and you're then left with those terrifying blanks. 6-second interval.
All right, then. I'm sorry. Guide me like you said you would.
Then let us get on with it. Let's explore what happened to send your family from that idyllic existence in Blunt out into the night on that bus.
He could still remember his father's voice in the cellar that day, and the ping-pong ball like a small planet suspended in space, his father's voice holding him captive, enthralled. And yet a small part of him was isolated and alone, a part that was not Adam Farmer any longer, but Paul Del Monte. "I am Paul Del Monte," a voice whispered inside of him. "Paul Del Monte." Then who is Adam Farmer? Where did he come from? And finally, his father told him that Adam Farmer had come into being a long time before, when the reporter who was Anthony Del Monte, and would someday be David Farmer, had uncovered certain documents, obtained certain information at the State House in Albany, information that would change a lot of lives irrevocably.
What kind of information?
He wasn't precise about it. But I know this much. It involved corruption in government.
At what level of government? State? Federal?
Both. And there was more than government involved. There were links.
What were these links?
Between crime, he spoke about the organizations, the syndicates, and government. From the local wards right up to Washington, D.C.
Was he specific about these links?
Now you're sounding like an investigator again. As if you're looking for specific information that has nothing to do with me as a person.
Everything has to do with you as a person. We have to be specific. Haven't you dealt in generalities, vaguenesses, long enough? Lack of specifics. Isn't that what gives you nightmares at 2 o'clock in the morning? 5 second interval.
I'm sorry. Anyway, he said the information he found, information that took him a year to uncover, made it necessary for him to become a witness, to testify in Washington, before a special Senate committee. Behind closed doors, no television cameras, no reporters. Later, there would be indictments, arrests. But the testimony had to be given in secret. Otherwise...
Otherwise what?
I remember his exact words. He said that otherwise, his life wouldn't be worth a plugged nickel. That was an expression I had never heard before. But I knew what it meant as soon as I heard it.
5 second interval. Go on.
He went to Washington. He testified. He gave evidence for investigators to follow up on. They said he'd be protected, his identity kept secret. He trusted them. He was away for almost a year, hiding in hotel rooms, coming home once in a while to visit my mother and me, while guards stood around the house, inconspicuous in the shadows. I was just a baby, 2 or 3 years old. He said he was riddled with guilt during all that time, but it was his duty, he said. He said he was an old-fashioned citizen who believed in doing the right thing for his country, to provide as much information as possible.
Earlier you said that he told you almost everything. What did you mean by that?
He said that there was a lot of information he couldn't give me, for my protection.
And how would this provide protection for you?
He said that if I was ever questioned about certain topics, certain information, I couldn't possibly give away the information if I didn't have it to begin with. He said I'd be able to pass lie detector tests or any other tests. In other words, I could always tell the truth, even if some fancy truth serums were used, and I'd never betray anything.
What do you think you would have betrayed? 6 second interval.
That's a funny question.
In what way is this question of mine, as you say, funny?
It's as if your question about betrayal is trying to make me betray something. I don't know. I'm confused.
Of course you're confused. May I make a suggestion? I suggest that this particular reasoning of yours, these doubts of yours, are a defense on your part. Whenever you are on the edge of revealing something important in your past, you stall, voicing suspicions of my questions because you're afraid, because you're reluctant to face your past.
I'm not afraid. I want to know.
Well, then let's go forward, not sideways, not backward.
All right.
5-second interval.
Where were we?
The testimony in Washington?
Well, finally it was over. He came back to Blunt, returned to his job. Mr. Campbell had given my father a leave of absence. He thought he'd been researching a book in Washington. The government had paid my father's salary. Anyway, it was all over. Done with. Indictments were issued. Quiet arrests made. Sudden resignations in Washington. But no heroics. My father didn't want any. He only wanted to resume his life again. Be with his family. And then it happened.
The bomb. Planted in the car. Waiting for his father to turn the key in the lock. But the explosion never occurred, because a local policeman had observed two strangers lurking near the Del Monte household. A telephone call from police headquarters warned his father to stay in the house. A crew of bomb experts appeared at the scene and towed the car away. A later report disclosed that a bomb, capable of destroying the car and everything within a 10-foot radius, had been located attached to the accelerator. The next attempt came 3 nights later. His father had worked late at the newspaper. He had felt nervous and edgy as he typed away, but he refused to give in to his feeling of uneasiness. Anyway, there was a police officer on duty at the entrance of the building, assigned by the police chief at the insistence of Roscoe Campbell. His father finished writing, a 3-part series on a possible scandal in the municipal purchasing department. No kickbacks this time, but rental fees paid for equipment that did not in fact exist. His father walked down the stairs. The sight of the police officer provided a touch of comfort. The police officer turned toward him, a gun in his hand. His father froze. The gun was raised, and his father saw the face, the expressionless eyes, the look of the hired killer, the hitman. A terrible sadness flooded him. He had let his wife down, his son. They would be left alone, abandoned. A pistol shot rang out, echoing as loudly as the detonation of a bomb. His father braced himself, and then saw, in slow motion, the policeman crumpling up, mouth agape, eyes bulging from their sockets. He fell forward, the gun loosed from his hand, dropping to the sidewalk. That was the night Mr. Gray entered their lives.
More specifics now, although you seem to dislike the word. Who finally was this Mr. Gray of yours? Until now you've made him seem like a phantom flickering in and out of your lives.
He worked for the government, the federal government. My father said that Mr. Gray had been involved from the beginning, from the time my father first gave testimony. He'd been on the sidelines, watching, waiting.
A bodyguard?
No, more than a bodyguard. My father said he was one of the original men involved in a new government department.
What was this department?
Let me think a moment.
5-second interval.
I remember the title now. The U.S. Department of Reidentification. It was supposed to protect people, to provide people with new identities, so they could hide.
Hide from what?
From those they testified against.
I am afraid it's not entirely clear to me.
Let me try to remember exactly what my father told me.
5-second interval.
My head is beginning to hurt, to pound.
Do you wish a pill?
No. I don't trust pills anymore.
Does that mean you don't trust me anymore?
I'm not sure of anything right now. Give me a minute to think. To think about all the things my father told me. All the things we talked about.
How they talked. Or rather, his father talked, and Adam listened. But Adam also asked questions, 100, 1,000, it seemed. During those first few days after the discovery of his identity and the lives they led, he and his father talked incessantly, the terrible silence finally broken. Sometimes they talked in the paneled room in the cellar, and at other times outside, walking the streets, sitting in a restaurant, lounging on a park bench. His father explained why they covered so much territory. The paneled room was a safe room. It had been searched for bugs, listening devices, by Gray's men and given clearance. If they didn't talk in that room, it was best to conduct their conversations while they were on the move, coming and going, in public places, where the chances of being overheard or eavesdropped on were negligible. It was during these conversations that his father brought him up to date, told him how they had become involved in this new life of theirs. In the final analysis, his father said, we really had no choice. Gray spelled out the options, the alternatives. He had helped to develop the Department of Reidentification. The department had grown out of a sudden need as people began to testify against organized crime. The first people to give testimony were criminals themselves, members of the organizations and syndicates who, for one reason or another, decided to turn against their own kind. In exchange, they asked protection. The early cases were provided with bodyguards, nothing else. Some of the first witnesses were convicts, and they had to be transferred to prisons where they couldn't be reached by the organizations. In some instances, new identities were created for witnesses who weren't in jail. They began new lives under assumed names. Adam and his father were walking by a schoolyard where some kids, mostly girls, were playing hopscotch and other games, their shouts and laughter innocent on the afternoon air. Adam suddenly felt like an alien. Gray explained the situation, his father continued, unaware of the children and the sunshine, head down, his eyes cruising the sidewalk. My life, as I had known it, he said, was ended. It was a matter of time before a bullet or a bomb or some other weapon finished me off. He had been my watchdog from the beginning. He and his men had alerted the police department when the bomb was placed in the car. One of Gray's men had shot the assassin who had impersonated the cop outside the newspaper office. Gray said that sooner or later the assassins would succeed. I couldn't be allowed to live, for a lot of reasons, the least of which was revenge. I had to be made an example to other people who might want to become witnesses. And they still didn't know how much I had really learned during the investigation, how much I could still tell the authorities, or how much I knew then that wasn't worth much, but might become important if later disclosures were made. His father kicked at a stone, watched it roll into the gutter. I'm not the hero type. I get scared too easily. But I tried to reason with Gray. I told him that I would take my chances, that this was still a free country, a country of laws, and that a citizen shouldn't have to go into hiding for his own protection. But Gray pointed out the clincher. He said that the bomb in the car hadn't been aimed at me alone, but at whoever happened to be in the car when it exploded, and most likely that would be my family. He said that you and your mother weren't any safer than I was, not as long as I continued to be Anthony Del Monte, resident of Blunt, New York. I remained unconvinced, feeling that there was something wrong somehow with our entire system, until I returned home after Gray's visit with me at the office and learned that your mother had received a phone call. A simple and brief phone call, in which someone quietly informed her that 2 funeral masses would be reserved in the next week at St. Joseph's Church, for her husband and son. Her punishment was that she would be allowed to live. The sun had no right to be so bright, the shouts of the playing children so happy. That night I called Gray, using a special number he had given me.
Thus your family came under the protection of this Department of Reidentification.
Yes. But it was different in those days. My father said they were amateurs at that kind of thing. Today, there's an official witness reestablishment program, that's the official name now, with authority handed down by Congress. It's all smooth and cool and streamlined. Entire families are relocated. provided not only with new identities, but with complete family histories, all documented, official. It's almost foolproof. But in those days, the program was new. We were one of the first families involved. There was money enough. In fact, my father said a trust fund was established to finance my college education. But there were a lot of rough edges. Gray and his people had to improvise, and sometimes they goofed.
How did they, as you say, goof?
Well, the birth certificates, for instance. When Mr. Gray brought us our new certificates, my birth date had been changed from February 14 to July 14. Mr. Gray was furious, my father said. He wanted us to keep our original birth dates so there'd be less confusion, less chance of slipping up accidentally and giving the wrong date in the future. My mother was upset, too. She said a mother simply couldn't accept a change in the birth date of her son. So Mr. Gray arranged for another certificate.
But your father kept both, you said.
He was afraid of another goof, that the July 14 date might have been recorded somewhere, and that I might need it in the future. So he didn't destroy it. He said it might have been a mistake on his part, but that he, too, had to improvise in those days.
And the names. Adam could still hear his father's voice, a mixture of anger and disgust when he talked about their new names. Farmer, for God's sake. Gray and his bunch came up with Farmer. White, American, Protestant. Wasp. And here I am Italian and your mother Irish. And both of us Catholic, your mother a devout Catholic who never misses Mass on Sunday or on holy days. Gray resorted to more improvisation, suggesting that the Farmer family be converts to Catholicism. This meant baptismal certificates, confirmation papers. We were like puppets, you, your mother, and I, his father said, as if we had no control over our lives. And we didn't, of course. Others pulled the strings and we jumped. Sometimes I think someone with a terrible sense of humor was toying with us. Look at the name they selected for you. Adam. Somebody's whim, maybe. Adam, new birth, first man, I don't know. Your mother and I felt helpless, but the thought of that bomb and that phone call made me go along. And so we found ourselves in Monument, Massachusetts.
Why Monument? Why this city out of so many others?
You sound bored.
Please, no more judgments on me.
As if you've heard all this before, and you're only going through the motions.
Time is too valuable to hear banal information repeated. If I knew why your Mr. Gray chose Monument as your new home, would there be any logical reason why I would ask you about it? 10-second interval.
I guess you're right. As usual. As far as Monument was concerned, my mother insisted on staying somewhere in the Northeast, my father said. Mr. Gray agreed, but not for sentimental reasons. He said it was a matter of lifestyle, of blending in with our surroundings. We'd have been conspicuous, say, suddenly turning up in Texas. So Mr. Gray arranged for us to settle in Massachusetts. Actually, the distance wasn't a problem, he said. Even without all the elaborate arrangements, there was little chance of anyone tracing us back to Blount.
What's the matter? You've suddenly grown pale. 7-second interval.
Let me take it easy for a minute or two.
23-second interval. What has upset you?
Something I remembered as I was talking. The reason why Mr. Gray wasn't worried about anyone tracing us back to Blount.
The cellar again. With his father. His mother upstairs. His father reached inside his jacket and pulled out an envelope. A narrow manila envelope, slightly larger than letter size. He held the envelope in the palm of his hand for a moment, as if his hand were a scale and he was trying to determine its weight, its value, its importance. Finally, he unsealed the envelope, carefully lifting up the scotch tape that crisscrossed it. He withdrew something that looked like a newspaper clipping, yellowed, fragile. He handed it to Adam. This was the insurance Gray City was providing us with, his father said, his voice filled with a bitterness Adam had never heard in his father's voice before. Adam looked down at a five-column headline that preceded a long news story. He didn't have to read the story. The headline told him all he needed to know. Blunt reporter, wife, child, killed in crash on highway.
I sat there, looking at the clipping and thought, I'm dead. I've already died.
Was it a shocking thought?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure of anything anymore. I think I was numb, the way I'm numb now.
Do you wish to suspend? It's been a grueling time for you. Important but grueling. A real breakthrough. But I think you should rest now. We can seek more details later.
Yes.
Let us suspend, then. End tape OZK-012.
I emerge from the drugstore and walk to the parking meter, and my bike is gone. The 5 o'clock crowd passes by on the sidewalk, hurrying home from the office or the factory, feet scurrying over the pavement. A bus halts with a hissing, and its doorway exhales people. Traffic lights flash on and off, and car horns sound. And I stand there, isolated by myself on a small, invisible island, and I look at the spot where my bike had been. I shouldn't have left it there unguarded. I have my father's package in my hand, and I hold it tightly, pressing it against my body, afraid that someone will rush by me and tear it from my grasp. I feel vulnerable, a headache beginning, a migraine maybe, a small spot of pain like a tumor throbbing in my forehead above my eye. I touch the spot with my hand as if the pain is visible, touchable by my fingers. But mostly, I stare dumbfounded at the spot where my bike had been. I look around to see if someone has played a trick on me, a prank, has hidden the bike somewhere nearby. The mouth of an alley looms between two stores, and I glance into the alley. Nothing but a few newspapers rolling in the wind, a rubbish barrel, and a cat with arched back poised next to the barrel. The cat hisses, and I turn away, glancing up and down the sidewalk. I encounter only strangers, and no bike. But the alley draws me again. If I had taken a bike, I'd have gotten out of there fast, and the most likely route was the alley, a quick getaway, instead of the open exposure of the street where someone could yell, "Stop, thief!" I return to the alley. It's narrow. Barely room for a boy and a bike to pass through, but I enter anyway. Running through the narrow passage, my shoulders brushing the rough brick exterior. The alley is so narrow that claustrophobia threatens me again and my palms turn wet with perspiration while drops of sweat gather in my armpits. I plunge onward, through the alley, bursting finally out of it and find myself in a deserted area behind the Main Street buildings. Rubbish barrels, a derelict car without wheels sunk in the ground, boarded up windows. Dusk hides whatever is in corners.
Lose something, honey?
I whirl around, surprised at the voice, because there's no one or nothing there.
Up here,
the voice says, a faint southern accent softening the words. He's standing on the fire escape landing, above me on the second floor. Squinting, I see that he is huge, a mountainous man, with a white shirt, open at the chest, although it's cold in the New England dusk. As my eyes become accustomed to the twilight, I see that his face is moist, his plump cheeks wet, his forehead soaked. He has a handkerchief, and he dabs ineffectually at his forehead. He leans against the iron railing of the fire escape, and the railing creaks in protest. Instinctively, I back away a step or two, afraid that the entire structure will collapse, come crashing down. Had he called me honey? Somebody stole my bike, I say. I left it in front of a store only for a minute or two, and when I came out it was gone.
That's right, honey. They'll steal anything these days. There used to be a saying, they'll steal anything that's not tied down. But these days they'll steal anything, even if it is tied down.
The more he talks, the more pronounced his accent becomes. I wonder if he can see my frown of distaste as I look at his monstrous body, all that sweat on a cold evening, and the way his lips pronounce the word honey. He repels me, but I'm sure he knows something about the bike. Why had he asked whether I'd lost something when he saw me standing there?
Did you see anybody come running through here with a bike? I ask. You stay in one place long enough, you see a lot of things, he says,
his tone taunting now, as if he wants to play a game.
Know what's hard? Being this way, stuck in a cage this way, and having to wait for everything to come to you, not being able to go after anything. See what I mean?
I see what he means. The iron railings and banisters and rungs of the fire escape are cage-like, and he is a prisoner in his weight and his bulk.
You live up there?
I ask, not wanting to play games, but not wanting to arouse his anger. He wouldn't tell me anything if I turned him off too fast.
In an apartment here, 4 rooms. I look out the front windows at Main Street, and I stand here on the fire escape and look at the back alleys.
He gestures behind him at a wide door, the kind of door through which deliveries are made.
At least the place has a good enough door. So I sit and wait and look, or I stand and wait and look, and sooner or later I see something.
I hope you saw my bike, I say. And whoever took it.
Folks lose things. They sometimes put an ad in the paper. You know, saying, lost, one bike, Main Streeter hooks it. Reward. Reward, honey, that's the key. You get something, you got to give a reward.
His voice drips with a heavy southern accent now, and he pronounces reward as reward. But there's something more than a southern accent in his voice. Something else lingers there, but I don't want to recognize it.
I'll give a reward,
I say, almost imitating his accent.
I've got $25 to give as a reward. There's all kinds of rewards, honey, he says. There's rewards and rewards.
And now, in the dusk, he begins to scratch at himself, scratching his chest where his shirt is open and where curly hair glistens. He scratches with both hands, descending to his stomach.
All kinds,
he says, his voice lingering in the twilight. I am conscious again of the migraine, the throb in my forehead. A wave of nausea crests in my stomach, and I taste acid and bile.
All I want is my bike,
I say, my lips trembling, and I'm sad and angry at the same time, because I feel like a small boy again, still the coward I always was. There's a whimper in my voice, and I hate myself for the whimper. And I hate the fat man up there on the fire escape for reducing me to this state. I also hate whoever took my bike, and now I throb with more than a migraine's pain, but with hate and anger. I stand helpless before him, shaking and trembling in the chill of evening, and I feel tears of helplessness and rage cold on my cheeks. His huge figure wavers in the wetness of my tears, as if he is somehow underwater.
Aw, tell him who's got his bike,
another voice intrudes, a sharp voice, with the flint of New England in the words. I wipe the tears away. The fat man sighs a huge sigh that's like a wind able to topple trees.
Go ahead, tell him.
The voice comes from inside the apartment, behind the fat man. The huge folds of flesh form a pout on the man's face.
Never can do what I want,
he says, himself a little boy now.
Tell him, Arthur,
the voice says.
The Varney boy, Junior, he took your bike,
the man says.
Come through the alley there about 15 minutes ago. He's always stealing something. Someday they're going to put him away. Where does he live?
I ask, sniffing, wondering how he can stand the cold.
Up a main street, next to the First Baptist Church. That's a joke. Junior Varney, biggest thief in town, living next to a Baptist church. You come in, Arthur. It's getting cold out there.
The voice of the unseen man calls from inside. Gently now. Tenderly. The big man looks down at me with a sadness in his eyes. Mournfully, he says,
I never get to do nothing. Thanks,
I yell up. Not at the big man, but at whoever's inside. For some reason, I look at the massive man and find myself saying,
I'm sorry.
I'm still sick to my stomach, and my head throbs, and I dread the prospect of tracking down Junior Varney, and I'm still repelled at the lewdness of the big man. But he really looks caged as he turns slowly away on the fire escape. So I say,
I'm sorry.
Again, and then I get the hell out of there.
Tape OZK013-0800. Date deleted, TA. You're looking well this morning.
Thank you.
You're alert.
I feel alert.
We are making excellent progress, are we not?
A lot of things are clearer now. Not everything, but enough. They give me the chills sometimes. But the chills are better than the blanks.
Good. I mentioned the necessity of specific details.
You're always talking about specifics. What kind of specifics?
I mean specific details as opposed to general information.
You mean details of our lives in Monument and how we came to be there?
Yes, that, of course. Also the whys of your presence in Monument.
But I've told you that. My father gave testimony, and this placed him in danger.
Did he ever tell you about his testimony, its nature?
No, there wasn't time.
What do you mean, there wasn't time? 9-second interval.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
You appear troubled. You're frowning. Is anything the matter?
Like a cloud, hanging in the distance, in his mind. Something dark lurking there. And the edge of panic again, a shiver in his bones, deep in his marrow.
Perhaps this line of questioning is disturbing you. Why not let the thoughts flow freely?
All right. It's just that for a minute there, I felt the blankness again. There are still blanks, you know.
And we shall fill those blanks eventually. Think of how far we've come to this point.
Do we still have a long way to go?
That depends.
You mean it depends on me?
To a certain extent, yes. And on these sessions, and the medicine. Tell me, did you grow close to your father after you had discovered the truth of the situation?
Yes. We spent a lot of time together. He kept apologizing for the predicament he had placed me in, had placed my mother in, too. But I was proud of him, really. I mean, he had done what he believed to be right. He had given up his career.
He remembered asking his father, tentatively, afraid that he was invading his privacy, how much it had hurt him to start life over, to give up his old life, his career, his friends. Adam thought how terrible it would be if he had to leave Monument now, to give up Amy and start again in a new town, a new section of the country. "Of course it hurt, Adam," his father said. "But it hurt your mother most of all. I didn't mind leaving Blunt. I had always figured that my career lay elsewhere. I had those dreams a young guy has, dreams of going to distant places, fame, all that stuff. But your mother loved Blunt, the people especially. The hardest thing for me, and I still miss it, was giving up newspaper work. I still hope that the situation will change and I'll be able to go back into the business someday. Gray figured it was too risky for me to continue in the same profession. Insurance didn't appeal to me. But the department always keeps its eye out for legitimate businesses they can buy or take over that one of their witnesses can operate. The insurance agency was available for me at the time. We had to build a new life, Adam. It was hard, naturally. But when you think of the alternative, we were glad to have a chance. There's always fear, though. Even today. Gray said our tracks are covered. 3 bodies cremated 10 years ago in Blunt, New York. But who knows? Who really knows?
Why does Mr. Gray come here to Monument so often?
To keep in touch. He brings a special bonus of money 2x a year. He also drops in to keep me up to date on developments. He also brings reassurances that we're still safe. Once in a while, he probes my memory for some lost fact, some overlooked detail that subsequent developments have made important. And there's another reason. He's never mentioned this reason, I only suspect it. I think he's keeping an eye on me.
But why?
I don't really know. Maybe to see that I haven't been reached by the other side. They were always on the move during these conversations, talking in snatches as they strolled the streets, visited the bazaar at St. Jude's Church, exchanging information as Adam aimed the ball at 3 wooden bottles arranged in a pyramid. Once, they went to a drive-in movie, and his father turned down the speaker while they conversed. A John Wayne film on the screen, Adam had forgotten the title. But he remembered asking his father why all these precautions with Mr. Gray were necessary 10 years after the testimony and threats. Watching John Wayne swagger across the street, gun riding low on his hip, his father said, "Because nobody knows how powerful these organizations, maybe there's more than one, are today. Nobody knows how far they might have penetrated the government." Adam was reluctant to use a certain word, but he went ahead anyway, pulling his eyes away from John Wayne on the screen.
"Does it involve the Mafia, Dad?"
The word sounded ridiculous coming from him, melodramatic, belonging on a movie screen maybe, but not in their lives. "I can't say who or what, Adam, for your own protection. Anyway, the Mafia is only a handy word for people to use. There are a lot of words to describe the same thing. As far as time is concerned, the evidence I gave has been used and reused. But there's a catch. No one knows whether I divulged all the information, everything I knew. That's another reason for all this surveillance. And maybe it's the real reason for Gray's trips here. He keeps probing for more information, and I tell him there isn't any more, that I've held nothing back. And he just looks at me. That look gives me the chills. Sometimes I think I'm an annoyance to him, an embarrassment. Sometimes, when he visits, we sit there like enemies. Or as if we're playing a crazy game that neither of us believes in anymore, but the game has to go on.
This information your father talked about, did he ever reveal its nature?
No.
Weren't you curious about it? After all, the information changed your lives.
He said he couldn't tell me, for my own protection. And I didn't press him for the information.
He said he told Gray that he was not holding back anything. Was he specific to you about that?
I don't know what you mean.
I mean, did you ever ask him whether he was telling Gray the truth or whether he was just being clever? 9-second interval. Why the sudden silence? You're looking at me in a strange manner.